topological line defects. So one-dimensional topological defects. Mostly in the context of two-dimensional topological field theories. Now, I should begin by explaining what do I mean with topological field theory. And there are two notions that are useful to have in mind, which are obviously not unrelated, but in practice somewhat different. So essentially, the question is, if you want to work, if you want to think about your theories having to do with vector spaces or with differential graded vector spaces. Now, as we saw in Phil's talk, often, even if you want to describe a theory of, you know, scalar fields or something very concrete, or gauge fields, it's useful to introduce homological technology to describe gauge symmetry, the BV formalism, and so on. But there is still somewhat a difference between a situation where the observables you're trying to build with this cohomological technology are living vector spaces, or theories where you're really very happy to work with differential graded vector spaces. So your typical physical theory, it's a theory where the local operators live in vector spaces or in supervector spaces, depending if your theory is bosonic or fermionic. On the other hand, a lot of mathematical applications involve the topological twist of supersymmetric theories. So it involves a situation where your theory has some underlying fermion symmetry, some fermionic symmetry generator that squares to zero, and you sort of want to pass through the cohomology of that generator. In that context, your theory is sort of intrinsically differential graded. So you can refer to this kind of theories, to this distinction as sort of quantum field theories and homological quantum field theories. Again, the boundary is not really sharp because of the BV formalism, but in practice it is. Now, so in a physical context, the way you get to topological field theories is essentially by having a quantum field theory which has an energy gap and looking at a very low energy behavior of the theory. So having an energy gap means that the correlation function of local operators decay exponentially when you bring the operators far from each other. And if you go a very low energy or very large distances, it means you're doing a lot of RG flow. So you're looking at correlation functions, so the operators are at extremely large distances. And so the correlation functions are essentially trivial. They reduce to the product of one-point functions of these individual operators. And essentially, all the operators look like the identity operator. In particular, because all distances are very large, if you take a derivative of an operator to move the operator a little bit, the correlation function is not going to change. So the derivative of operators are zero in a physical topological field theory. So sort of physical topological field theory is a theory where roughly the derivative of operators is zero, are zero. The true condition is a little bit stronger. It involves the stress tensor, but we haven't introduced the stress tensor yet, so I will not discuss it for now. Now in a cohomological or homological TFT, instead, the derivative of operators is not zero, but is Q exact. So typically, you really have some sort of a homology, like the Q dagger that Matt introduced in his lecture, with a property that the anticommutator of Q dagger and Q, where Q is the differential, is the derivative. So this means that correlation functions will be independent of the position of points, up to homotopies, up to quasi-isomorphisms. So up to quasi-isomorphisms, sorry. And there will be still a lot of information hidden in the homotopies which relate different configurations of points. On the other hand, here, correlation functions for different configurations of points are equal on the nose. There are no homotopies. I call this physical because, as I said, this topological field theories really occur in concrete systems. They are very important when you study problems in, say, condensed matter physics or high energy physics, and your system is gapped. The technology you use to study these two examples is different. I mean, there are a lot of similarities, of course, but there are some important concrete differences. And I think this setup is reasonably well understood now, mathematically and physically, although there are a lot of interesting open questions. This setup is richer, and I think that, at least personally, I know much less about this. And that's why I'm going to lecture today on this, because I love to lecture about things I don't understand so that the audience can explain them to me later. A few years later, maybe, but, you know, in due time. But still, this is definitely a subject which will be worth lecturing about. And maybe next week I'll come back to it, depending on what the interest of the audience is. Just to give a flavor of the difference, if I study line defects in a physical topological field theory, the local operators on these line defects will form an algebra. Simply because I can just move them along the defect and bring them together. Also, if I have multiple line defects, and I talk about the space of local operators which interpolate between them, I get to compose local operators between L1 and L2, and local operators between L2 and L3 into local operators between L1 and L3, just by bringing them together topologically again. So typically, in this world, you have categories of line defects, where the homes are vector spaces or supervector spaces and adjust the space of local operators interpolating between the two lines. So physical topological field theories is all about categories and higher categories. You get higher categories because then you can think about surfaces in which these line defects can live, and how surfaces can be collided or lines can be collided. And you get all sorts of higher dimensional operations. On the other hand, in the nomological topological field theory, things are a bit more complicated. If I try to collide operators, I can possibly get an algebra, or some kind of an operation at least, but there are subtleties. Because, for example, here I clearly cannot have divergences simply because the correlation functions don't depend on the distance. Here the correlation function depends on the distance up to exact things. So the collision of operators can have divergences. These operators might not be closed even. Q-closed. And even if they are Q-closed, there might be a divergence which is Q-exact. So if I pass to cohomology, I will get an algebra. But if I try to keep information about my original operator algebra, I need to be more careful. I cannot define an operation simply by bringing things together. Instead, I might have to define my operation by just keeping them at some cutoff distance. And then you'll get all sorts of troubles with associativity. You will not get associativity on the nodes. Instead, you'll have homotopies that control the associator. So I will discuss it a bit in better detail later, but one of the outcomes is that... So there are different ways to describe the situation. In the past, in a lot of physical situations, I've seen described in terms of A-infinity algebras. An alternative, better approach is to think about E1 algebras, as far as I understand, which you can sort of think about encoding all the OPEs of operators on your line defect and all the homotopies that relate OPE for different collections of points. Of course, if you ask, if you check, you know, if you read Wikipedia or I don't know, the category of, you see statements like the infinity algebras are the same as E1 algebras in some appropriate sense, you know, up to quasi-isomorphism. I will try to discuss a little bit more concretely during the lecture what this same means. How, you know, if I'm giving a topological, homological, topological line defect in some theory, how do I, in practice, learn, read off something like an infinity algebra? But anyway, so you get A-infinity operations, you get all sort of homotopies for association, for associators. And more generally, you get some A-infinity categories. Of line defects. So, at least, you know, in its most. So, now, in mathematics, there are a lot of things which can be interpreted as categories of line defects. One example would be the derived category of coherent sheaves on a nice Keller manifold. But in order to get those descriptions starting from your topological field theory, presumably you need to work harder. And I'm actually quite curious to hear from the audience, concrete ways to understand how do I go from, say, any one category of line of boundary conditions for the B-twisted sigma model to a direct category of coherent sheaves. So for now, I'll try to stick to the mathematical structure. It sort of seems to stay closer to the underlying physical setup. But there are a lot of manipulations you can do on these mathematical structures later to make them more amenable of calculations. In the same sense that, say, an infinity algebra, for example, can be made quasi-isomorphic to a differential graded algebra usually. So for calculations, you might want to manipulate this algebra further. But the physical theory does not give you a differential graded algebra on the nodes.
So can E1 algebras also be described in terms of the construction?
Sorry?
Can E1 algebra mm-hmm. be defined in terms of
Bohr construction somehow? Do you mind? I don't know. So my problem is that I don't know much about E1 algebras. I know I have a physical intuition of what an OPE is, and I know that the E1 algebra is just a collection of all these OPEs together with the homotopies that relate them. At least this should be a model for the E1 algebra, but I'm definitely not an expert of all the possible models for that. So anyway, so if you want to work in homological topological field theories, you need to be ready to have more complicated structures than in the physical topological field theory. So here I'm going to study one-dimensional topological field theories in an homological topological field theory. Now, to get some intuition, is actually useful to go back to the setup that Matt was explaining about supersymmetric quantum mechanics and its topological twist. So supersymmetric quantum mechanics was just an example of an homological topological field theory in one dimension, where we don't have to worry about some environment where this topological line is leading. So if you remember, the quantum mechanics was defined by some Hilbert space on which some operator algebra was acting. And among the operators, there were a couple supercharges, one with square to zero, which was used as to twist the theory, to take cohomology of. And another one, which was used to sort of give you the homotopy for translations, in the sense that the commutator of Q and Q dagger is the Hamiltonian, which is the same as the generator of time translations. So the first question I would like to ask is, if I'm given this setup, how do I deform it? How do I explore nearby quantum mechanics? Well, there is not much deformation to the level of the Hilbert space. It's a Hilbert space. What you can do is to try to deform your operator, your supercharges, among other things. So I could deform my Q to some Q plus X, and my Q dagger to some Q dagger plus X dagger. I know that this supercharge should be still nilpotent. I will need something like QX plus X squared equal to zero. This is a very important equation. It's the Morey-Cartan equation. For the differential graded algebra of local operators that Matt denoted as A. And now, of course, the deformation of Q dagger will also have to satisfy some nice relation. And once I deform the two supercharges, I get for free a deformation of the Hamiltonian. See, there will be something like Q dagger X, and then Q X dagger. Plus XX dagger. So if you're thinking about the physical theory defined by the Hilbert space and Hamiltonian, clearly the deformation of the Hamiltonian is the thing you're after. These are just symmetries, extra symmetries of your theory. And you can hope for the deformation of the Hamiltonian to be compatible with these symmetries. But for us, the main actor is this supercharge. So this is what we really care about, and the effect that this has on the rest of the theory. In particular, the deformation of Q dagger is really not very important for what I want to discuss, and I'm just going to suppress it. So a solution of the Morey-Cartan equations give me a way to deform the supercharge. And that, in turn, deforms the Hamiltonian. Now, this deformation of the Hamiltonian can be also expressed as a deformation of the action. So the action is deformed by something like the integral from infinity to infinity in time of this anticommutator of Q dagger and X. Okay. So now, when a modification of the let me see if I can sort of go back and derive this from this. So suppose I'm trying to deform a theory. Right? The correlation functions, if I deform the action, because the correlation functions are morally speaking the result of a path integral, the new correlation functions are obtained from the correlation functions of the old theory by just inserting the exponential of this. I mean, let me just ignore the h-bar. Now, I need to be careful when I compute this exponential with an expression like that, because this operator is integrated over all time, this deformation. The individual operators live at some times. So, you know, I have to insert in practice, if I think about this correlation function in the operator sense as have a state in the past, I'm acting with a sequence of operators, and then a state in the future, the order in which these operators act is the same as the order in which they're in time. It's really not much of an important observation. It's just that if you want to compare sort of correlation functions with that you obtain from a path integral with expectation values of operators in quantum mechanics, you need to always remember that the path integral produces time-ordered correlation functions. In particular, I can expand this exponential. And for simplicity, let me first consider the case where there are no operators, and then I'll put operators back. So if I study this perturbatively, what do I need to do? Well, I expand this exponential as something like 1 plus the integral from minus infinity to infinity of this object integrated in t. And then I would have to do 1/2 of this squared. But because of operator ordering, and I mean, there is no difference between putting an operator here and one here or vice versa. So I can just write something like an integral from minus infinity to infinity, an integral from minus infinity to t1, say, or this operator as a function of t1, the same operator as a function of t2, dt1, dt2, etc. So this is called the path order exponential. It's a construction which occurs a lot. For example, you are studying the exercise I gave you on Wilson lines, you probably encountered the path order exponential. And from the point of view of this sort of descent relation, so I'm taking a collection of these x's, I'm applying the descent on them to get things that can be naturally integrated, and then I'm integrating them over the configuration space of points on the real line.
I'm sorry to go back to something from a little earlier.
Yes.
For posterity. So that line below the 8.
Looks yes.
Like it says S plus that.
No, S, sorry. The original S is replaced by, yes. I could say the S deformed by X equals, that's better. And this would be the Q deformed by X. Okay. So I can ask, when is this expression Bierstein invariant? No, this is written in the original theory. So I should use the original Bierstein symmetry. So let's compute the Bierstein variation of this expression. The Bierstein variation of 1 is 0. The Bierstein variation of this it's a total derivative. Then here I get two terms. Etc. Now I can integrate by parts. This drops out. But here, I get something interesting when I integrate by parts. Because, see, the integration contour has a boundary where the two points collide. Actually, I was careless. I did not, x does not, is not exact, is not closed. So, if I do q of q dagger of x, this is the same as minus q dagger of qx plus dtx. So there is another, there are other terms that are important, where I have integral from minus infinity to infinity of q dagger of qx. Let me just write it as qx, okay. And here there will be other terms where there is, a double integral with the descendant of x and the descendant of qx. Okay. But the important point is that when I integrate by parts, see, here I lose one of the integrals. And what I'm left is something which is integrated over the whole line. So this can be written as sort of a sum of terms which contain the combination qx plus x squared. See, when I integrate this by parts, I get sort of x q dagger x plus q dagger xx, and q dagger is derivation, so I can rewrite it as q dagger of x squared. Then the next term will have a double integral. There will be some q dagger x, and this q dagger acting on the Morey-Cartan equation, etc., etc. So you see that somehow inserting this Pathodorus exponential in the correlation function preserves the BRST symmetry if the Morey-Cartan equation is satisfied.
What is the integrand of your path over
x? Sorry?
What is the integrand of xi?
No, this is just a bra. I'm sorry. I was being lazy. I didn't want to write q dagger x many, many times.
Okay.
I'm sorry. And so whenever you see this wiggle, it's because there was a q dagger acting on something. So I was sort of wanted to use quantum mechanics setup to illustrate this idea that there is this nice relation between Morey-Cartan elements and deformations of your line defect, and vice versa. And to relate the two, you take a solution of the Morey-Cartan equation, you apply the descent to it, and you Pathodor exponentiate it. Now, I know, but it's so nice and pristine. I will use it. I will use it. Don't worry. I know. I want to keep the right-hand side of the board for annoying calculations, of which there will be a lot for infinity, whenever you have infinity stuff. And the left side of the board for more clean statements. Let me discuss a little bit more the properties of this sort of Morey-Cartan equations. I don't know how much Morey-Cartan equations are familiar to the audience. but they are a lot of fun. So one important point is that Morikatan equations are also well defined for A infinity algebras. So if you have an infinity algebra with some operations that Matt described, denoted as mu n, which take your algebra to the power of n and map it to the algebra in degree shifted by 2 minus n, then you can write down a, see, this degree shift is just selected in such a way that it makes sense to write down a nice equation, where you take mu 1 of x plus mu 2 of x plus mu 3 of x, and so on and so forth, and you set it to 0. Notice that if x is degree 1, which is the sort of thing you would use to deform a supercharge, then all of the terms in this sum have a degree 2. So it makes sense to add them up. Now, whenever you find a solution of this Morikatan equation, now, of course, here there is infinite sum, and you should worry. This equation, I mean, if you give me a generic infinity algebra, the equation might not be very sensible, right? But in all, like, I would say that from my point of view, in all situations where it makes sense to consider the formations of a physical, of some physical object, it will make sense to solve this equation. There will be some triangularity condition or some other nilpotency condition which makes this equation well defined. But I do not know the general mathematical theory of when this equation makes sense. Anyway, if you give me a solution of this equation, at least formally, I can define a deformation of the original A infinity algebra, where, say, the deformation of the first operation, just, so the algebra, the vector space underlying the algebra is the same, but the operations are deformed in a way that is analogous to this. Now, writing this formula in infinity algebra is always very tedious, and there are all sorts of Kozul signs that are important. Whenever I write plus in this formula, it's really either plus or minus, and I refuse to write the correct sign because I never remember it. And there are very smart ways to think about these signs, but I've not absorbed them. But essentially, the idea is that, for example, to define the first operation, you just place your argument in one of the slots, and you put x in all the other slots and adapt all the possible ways of doing so. And the Pisa pattern that persists, a lot of important equations or axioms in infinity algebras are written by taking these gadgets and plugging into one of the entries of the other gadget and adding up over all possible ways to do so with Kozul signs. So now the deformation of the second operation will involve the original operation plus corrections which have to do with the next operation and all the other ones. Okay. And so on and so forth. Okay, so Morikatan equations, in a sense, give a perturbative description of the deformations of an infinity algebra. And when we use infinity algebras to describe the operators on the line defects, the Morikatan equation is a natural way to think about the deformation of the defect. You should literally think that there is some descent relation, which I'll describe momentarily, that you apply to x, to make it into a Gauss number 0, one form, which is then integrated and part order exponentiated. So it's integrated in and added to the action. Okay. So this is just a mild generalization of this sort of formula. Now, there is a notion of A infinity morphism. Between two A infinity algebras, which is really an infinite tower of operations, which map, the n tensor power of A into B shifted by 1 minus n, I think. And these morphisms are something that you can use to. So there is a notion of morphisms, and there is a notion of quasi-isomorphism. Which is essentially a morphism for which the first map is a quasi-isomorphism, roughly. So a nice property of infinity morphisms is that if you give me a Morel Cartan element for A, so the satisfy axioms I will not write down, just imagine them. But the important property is that if I have a Morel Cartan element for A, I can build a new Morel Cartan element which is a Morel Cartan element for B. So a way to understand these A infinity morphisms and quasi-isomorphisms is that physically is that you have some line defect. You sort of extracted painfully from the OPEs and homotopies some A infinity structure on the algebra of local operators. This is not there is no unicity in this operation. You can do it in many different ways. It will give you different but quasi-isomorphic A infinity algebras. And then there must be a way to describe deformations of the defect in all of these algebras. And so in each of these descriptions, there will be some Morel Cartan equation. And you can sort of think about the most general way of deforming, of taking Morel Cartan equation and redefining x by powers as a power series on x, and in such a way that the structure remains there. One way you can think about this is that, for example, when you do this, whatever calculations you're doing, you'll have to renormalize your theory and your operators. And this renormalization is often something non-polynomial. If I have, remember the quantum master equation, right? In the quantum master equation, you had, you're trying to compute some effective action, right, in terms of, and you're solving a nonlinear equation for this effective action. So if I try to change one of the couplings a little bit, renormalization will force me to change all the other couplings in a way which is polynomial in the original deformation. This x can be really thought of as some kind of a topological effective action, and I would love to have a sharp version of that statement. Let me give it as an exercise, after all. You had the big formalism yesterday. So, and these sort of quasi-isomorphisms are a redefinition of your fields and of your couplings, which leaves the theory unchanged. Anyway, I'm sorry for the amount of algebraic structure I'm throwing at you, but I want to stress that this structure really emerges unavoidably, every time you start studying some topological defects. For example, a few years ago, with Witten and Moore, I was studying topological line defects, boundary conditions, in two-dimensional theories which are gapped. So we were trying to understand what could we say about the category of line defects in theories that we know to be gapped. It's kind of interesting because the fact if a theory being gapped or not is a very non-perturbative statement. So you can hope that the physical intuition about that could give you interesting mathematical structures which would not be visible at first sight. And again, just so working very concretely in terms of particles propagating in this gap, massive particles propagating in this gap theory and interacting with the boundaries, we ended up with all this sort of infinity technology forced on us by the physical setup. So that also converted me from thinking this was just some mathematical formalism that should be avoided as much as possible to a faith in the true physical meaning of these infinity structures. Although, of course, as I was saying, the truly physical thing, I guess, is the E1 algebra or whatever encodes the OPEs, modulo homotopies. And this is already a bit of a derived notion. And let me discuss that a bit more. So,
can I ask?
Mm-hmm.
Where
yes.
Are you using the quasi-isomorphism? Are you assuming that P will only be a quasi-isomorphism?
I'm assuming that whenever you renormalize, if we're giving a theory by field as an exercise to study, and you renormalize it, and I renormalize it, we're not going to get the same operator algebra. But it will be related by quasi-isomorphism. And I should stress that quasi-isomorphisms are not innocent things. You know, they're not equalities. So, for example, right, as I said, this equation is kind of subtle because it has infinitely many terms. This formula is definitely subtle too, it has infinitely many terms. So it's an attempt to do a perturbative redefinition of whatever rules you're using to study your theory. But I may be using this equation to study non-infinitesimal deformation. Maybe I have a line defect, which is rigid, has no infinitesimal deformation, but has a rich enough algebra of operators that allows me to find a Mercator equation, a solution of Mercator equation, a Mercator element, which describes some faraway line defect, which is very different from the original one. Faraway not in space-time, just in the space of possible defects. But it's perfectly possible that this defect might be visible to you in your construction because you kept a lot of the interesting operators of the theory. While perhaps I simplified my operator algebra too much and I passed to cohomology and I lost, you know, until I only see the small fluctuations and this operator had no small fluctuations. So in other words, these are not innocent operations. And again, I don't know what is the precise mathematical theory that tells me which quasi-isomorphisms preserve interesting Mercator elements and which ones lose them.
Wait, David, I just want to object that you're conflating two things here.
Mm-hmm.
You said if you pass the cohomology, you lose a lot of information.
Yes.
That's true. But passing the cohomology is very different than moving along a quasi-isomorphism.
Absolutely, but passing to cohomology is an example of quasi-isomorphism.
No.
Yes.
No.
I mean, if I have an infinity algebra, I can sum over three, you know, I have an homotopy between the algebra and the cohomology. I can, there is a quasi-isomorphism between the algebra and the cohomology, I think.
No. No?
Well, okay.
It depends what you mean. If you give the cohomology an infinity structure such that you get a quasi-isomorphism.
Yes, that's what I mean.
Okay.
That's right.
Okay, sorry.
And
I think usually when mathematicians say pass the cohomology, they mean something different.
Okay, I meant, let me have a description where Q is trivial. Okay, that's an important simplification of the theory, and there's a very good chance that we'll lose something.
This is not necessarily a homotopy
Right. I'm really more worried about issues of convergence. See, there are some very physical meanings to this sort of, I mean, I'm setting it mathematically, but there is physics behind this. There are two basic ideas. For example, I should never integrate away massless degrees of freedom in physics, because that will make my action on local and out of control. Using the Hong quasi-isomorphism here, it's probably analogous to integrating away like degrees of freedom I was not allowed to integrate away in physics. Another observation I can do is that if my theory has a perturbative description, at least in the ultraviolet, operators have a scaling dimension. And deformations must involve, I mean, renormalizable deformation of an action are usually operators of scaling dimension 1, which means that X has scaling dimension 0. Now, we did not introduce the notion of scaling dimension, so for me, so I don't know if I should mention it, but let me just say that there is, you know, in a physical setup, there is definitely a filtration of your space of operators, in perturbation theory at least, where there are operators which are more important than others in describing deformations. So an operator of dimension 1,000 will never be reasonably added to the action to make a deformation of the defect. And so I would feel perfectly fine if your quasi-isomorphism throws it away. You know, if I have a scalar field and act on it with 10 derivatives, probably I don't need to worry about that. If you throw away the scalar field itself, I should worry more. So I think there must be a very interesting theory here, which I don't know if it's universal or perhaps model dependent, in the sense that you might have to develop a theory for, I don't know, B-twisted topological field theories, or I don't know. But definitely you should keep in mind that quasi-isomorphisms are useful, but you don't want to throw away the baby with the bathwater. If your objective is to describe other line defects besides the one that you have been given. So let me briefly give you the analog of this sort of statements for a general defect. So how do I define the path order exponential of a descendant of an operator in a situation where I'm careful? So being careful means that now I need to be aware that, for example, I should never allow operators to come too close together because there will be divergence. So being careful means renormalizing this expression, working in such a way that operators never collide, and carefully adding counterterms to make sure that the effect of this renormalization does not depend, that the final answer does not depend on these sort of choices of how closely to allow my operators to come to each other. So if I want to be careful, operators are not even attached to points. Operators are attached to intervals. So if I have an interval AB, I can get some observables living in interval AB, open interval. So, you know, intuitively you can think about this interval as something that is protecting my operator. I have an operator, I put it in the middle of the interval. If I make sure that my intervals never overlap, I can be confidently say that my operators are not colliding. Then the sort of E1 algebra that I was discussing, but not presenting concretely, should give me, at least morally, some maps which sort of take many observables, say on some interval 0L. By sort of, so in a topological field theory, all these observable spaces will be quasi-isomorphic. They will not, you know, there will be quasi-isomorphisms that relate operator algebras on different segments, and homotopies that allow me to sort of compare composition, you know, situation where I say I take a certain number of copies of this interval 0L and I map it, so maybe bigger, for example, to, well, let me say it's to a collection of other intervals on the real line. So there will be some operation which where I take the operator, a collection of operators on this interval. I use quasi-isomorphism to shrink the interval to some smaller intervals, and I place the operators wherever I want on the line. Okay, let me call these operations E. In the way I visualize E in one algebra, these are the basic operations of the algebra. And I'll get operations that just take a bunch of operators and map them to a configuration. But I also get homotopies between these maps. So if you give me really any cycle in the configuration space of n segments on the line, I should get a map associated to this cycle, which intuitively is taking the descendant of a bunch of these operators and integrating over the space of over this cycle. And then the fact that these are homotopies should be captured by the fact that if I take the commutator of Q with these maps, I should get the map for the boundary of the cycle. So all of this sort of manipulation we're doing for the Pathorder exponential should be sort of a simple example of that, where we were not careful about segments and we're using points. And so in order to define a renormalized Pathorder exponential, I will pick a certain collection of these gammas. And apply them to n copies of my deformation. Where these gammas are now, belong to C, the cycles of dimension n minus 2. I think. N minus 1. Minus 1. Chain. Yeah, sorry, not cycle. Chain. Yeah. Well, what is this the right symbol?
Yeah.
Okay. So don't listen to the word. The symbol is probably pseudo correct. Right. And now I want. See. Let me see. If I have one operator, I want one integral. If I have two operators, I want two integrals. So we'll say that gamma n is an n chain in the configuration space of n point of n segments. Okay. And now I can take the Bieresty variation of this. Right? So what's going to happen? So I want to study the action of Q on this sum. So I can commute Q through. And I'm going to get expressions where one of the x's has been replaced by qx. And then I get another correction which involves the boundary of these cycles, which are the locations where the two segments are coming close to each other intuitively. Now, picking these cycles is sort of my renormalization scheme. I'm deciding how to deal with this integral of operators on the line and how to make sure that they don't collide too badly. So it's up to me to select how, you know, how the size of the segments change, for example, as I integrate them along the line. I might decide that my segments become a bit shorter when the operators come close, or things like that. But in general, I will keep the sizes of the segments of order L. Maybe smaller than L, maybe a bit bigger than L, depends on what I want to do. But I want to keep in mind a scale, analogous to the renormalization scale that Phil had in his lecture. So in order to proceed, it better be that the boundary of these cycles is somewhat related to the cycles with smaller n. In the derivation I gave originally, it was important that the integration cycle, the boundary of the integration cycle, was the location where two points collided, and then what was left was just the integration cycle for n minus one points. So tentatively, I could try to impose that the boundary of gamma is sort of gamma composed with some gadget. So essentially, gamma n minus 1 composed with some gadget. So what this means is that I take my cycle gamma n minus 1, and then the gadget tells me how to embed in one of the segments, choose smaller segments, so that this can represent the boundary of this. So I'm sort of summing of all the possible ways of inserting a gadget in the slots of this cycle. But this is not going to work because if I take the boundary of the boundary, I'm not going to get zero. Essentially, when I take the boundary of the boundary, I'm going to see an associator, some situation where I apply M2 to itself. So that perhaps, so if I apply M2 to itself, I'll get a term that looks like I replace these with two smaller segments. And I need to compare it with the situation where I replace this guy with two smaller segments. So this will not vanish. In other words, this prescription is going to give me trouble where three segments are close together. And so I can correct it. By another gadget, which now, so M2 was a point, was a zero cycle in the configuration space of segments inside 0L. M3 is going to be a one cycle in the configuration space of three segments inside a bigger segment. Some one cycle which sort of gives me the homotopy, the interpolation between these and these. So M3 sort of is represented by a picture like that. And then this will still not stop because there will be further problems in the boundary of the boundary, but I can keep going. So it says I'm trying to build a purely geometric renormalization scheme, which is theory independent. Usually it would be crazy, but in a topological setup, you can actually do it. Now, you don't have to use this renormalization scheme. You might choose to do some other theory-dependent scheme. But I expect that whatever you get is going to be ultimately quasi-isomorphic to what I'm describing.
Sorry, W, I don't understand what's going on right now. Maybe because we haven't learned what a renormalization scheme is yet. But
it's a way to define something which naively involves collision of operators without ever colliding the operators. That's it.
Can I try to summarize what I think you're doing?
Yes.
So you'd like to multiply operators.
you yes. have this problem that you don't want to put the operators at exactly the same place.
That's right.
But if you don't put them exactly at the same place, then you have to choose where to put them. And like,
that's right. It's not associative. And then I need to have an homotopy, which...
So you're trying to describe a way of kind of averaging over some set of choices,
mm-hmm.
which is why you have to choose a cycle or some subset of the configuration space and integrate over that and think of that as your set of possible choices
right.
for how to multiply the operators.
Right. That's okay.
Oh, yeah, I wasn't done yet. So this first set of equations, that was kind of describing the general scheme of the kind of thing you want. And now you're trying to tell us, well, how do I pick these gamma n's in a good way?
Yes.
Well, first, I kind of choose my rule for taking two things and put them inside one thing,
mm-hmm.
and then I kind of gradually build on it.
So that's correct.
At each state, I can't do stuff that's sort of associative on the nodes, but I have this machinery of infinity algebras, which is exactly what I need to fix that.
That's correct. So I will not repeat the question, but I repeat the answer. Well, okay, I repeat the question as an answer.
So right. The case that you first picked M2, and then after that, like, that's what this
I'm trying to discover why I need the MNs.
Yes, but what choices are you making? You're picking some cycles, right? You said, like, yes. I want to pick some certain...
Well, I was trying to build some cycles to define my renormalization scheme.
Yes, you first picked...
Well, I was looking for gammas. That's right. That was my problem. Find gammas for which I can prove reasonably well that this is Q-closed. And I saw, oh, to do that, I better be able to relate the boundary of gammas to simpler gammas.
So you started by picking gamma 2?
Well, yes, that's good. That's right. No, you're right. You are perfectly right. I start by picking gamma 1, and that has no boundary and no problem. Then I pick a gamma 2. And, a generic gamma 2 would not work because in order to compare it with gamma 1, it better be that when the segments get close, they fit inside this bigger segment. So that's the only constraint I need on gamma 1. I need that if on gamma 2. I need a gamma 2 when the boundary gamma 2, at the boundary of gamma 2, the two segments have been squeezed so that they fit within 0L again. Yes, it does. The segments have a size.
Yeah, it's a configuration space of segments, not of points.
And this is important. I spent 2 days trying to make things work with points. And then I realized that these squeezing things are actually important. They have a physical meaning. There is kind of a renormalization scheme going on here of a scale, trying to sort of understand how your theory behaves under scale transformations. That's right. Let's draw pictures, right? So gamma 1, I take a segment, say of size 0L. I don't see why it's to change the size. And I integrate it over all possible positions of this segment. This would be gamma 1. For gamma 2, well, I have two segments which, you know, when they're far from each other, they could be of size 0L. But when they come close, I better squeeze them a little bit so they still fit within 0L when they're closed. And this statement defines the gadget M2, which tells me how close did they and how squeezed did I let them get at the boundary. Right, so I want that when three segments are coming together, they fit inside 0L when they're sufficiently close, when I'm sufficiently close to the point where they all three are near each other, in such a way that an expression like this makes sense. So that I can use M3 to sort of correct for the homotopy between the two different ways of three things coming together. And my visualization, here my visualization skills have already failed, just about how to visualize in my mind, leave alone how to draw a picture. But in order for the boundary of the boundary to be zero, you get a natural constraint that's sort of sum of m, n, mk composite n minus k should be zero. So that M3 is an associator for M2, M4 is an associator for the lower operations, and so on.
So is the scheme the choice of gamma, or is it the choice of M?
Both.
David, you must be just be somehow be repeating the proof of the A infinity algebra.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
You're just writing down U1 off.
Yes.
Okay. I just wanted to confirm that.
Yes, and I don't know what is the right, you know, if that's your favorite way to relate A infinity to E1. But this seemed to be a physically meaningful way to relate E1 to A infinity. I strongly object to calling same things that are quasi-isomorphic. They are quasi the same. okay? Equivalent, yes. But actually, when you say that two things are equivalent, right? Are they? It means that somebody can constructively show that these are equivalent, right? And so somewhere there must be implicit a picture like this. I mean, in practice, right? Suppose I want to study a line defect. It's not equivalent to have a list of, an infinite list of operations, or operation classified by chain in the space of in this configuration space of segments. At least in my mind, this is much more infinite than the other. Often I'll be able to write down completely the A infinity relation for a specific defect. I will never be able to write down completely the E1 algebra relations for a line defect. You know, fit it in a page. So for calculations, it's really important to be able to go down to A infinity. And perhaps from there to go somewhere else, right? To an algebra, to differential graded algebra, or represent, you know, to a quiver or whatever. Whatever you can do in a specific situation.
But then,
no, that's a good question. That's right. So my model now is segments within a segment.
That's just E1. Like that's literally.
No, a specific choice of segments within within a segment. So, okay, until I try to give this lecture, my model was for the product I take 2 points, two operators, I put them at 0 and 1. For the second product, for the third product, I take the third the middle operator, I do the descent, and I integrate it between the original two. The sort of thing that Matt was discussing. You know, if I want to define the fourth operation, I take two guys and I integrate them, do their descent, and integrate them in between. But I have not been able to find a good way to recognize this model in a physical setup. This model definitely worked for me in the paper with Moore and Witten. I believe it's because we were working in the far infrared and everything had been, but even so, implicitly, there were some segments. We just didn't, okay. I don't want to say anything about that for now. I just leave it at these pictures, but once you had this, this allows you to replace this term, right, with something like that, where one of the arguments has been replaced by the operation for mn, for mk, acting on a bunch of x's. And so now I can solve this equation, I can sort of collapse this equation to a Morey-Cartan equation, where I define operations, infinity operations using this day one operations associated to this cycles, chains. And then this becomes the Mora-Karpan equation for this. More precisely, yeah, you find the Mora-Karpan equation for this algebra inserted in one of the slots of this sum. Okay. And so from a physical setup, you can recognize the infinity analog of this Mora-Karpan equation and the formation of the action. And right, I made a lot of arbitrary choices in here, and there will be homotopies between all of these choices. So different geometric renormalization schemes will definitely be related by quasi-isomorphisms. Also, the fact that all my operators never come close than distances of order L is physically very interesting, because it means I really have a family of infinity algebras. And suppose that my underlying theory has an interesting RG flow, so that at short distances it looks really very different from the theory at long distances. This happens all the time. That means that concretely, these operations will look very different.
Does this happen for topological field theories?
Sure. If I take a B-twisted CP1 sigma model, it's based on the physical sigma model on CP1. The physical sigma model has a very interesting RG flow, which is non-perturbative, and goes from a sigma model to something else, which has sort of two massive vacua and a bunch of particles between these vacua. Mathematically, it's very hard to reconstruct this data from the original theory because it's not perturbative. But I can compute the infinite operations in that infrared description. And I will get something which is quasi-isomorphic to a calculation done in the UV in terms of holomorph, you know, the right category of coherent sheaves on CP1. So this is not a, you know, this, the fact that you get to pick your L is not, it's really has a lot of physical, it means that the better you understand the physics of your theory, the more interesting mathematical structures you can gain. So every non-perturbative insight about your theory will be converted into some non-trivial statement about your mathematical structure. And right, I would really love to understand concretely, not up to quasi-something, what's the relation between the quantum master equation in a perturbative description of the theory and these A infinity structures. So if you give me a solution of the quantum master equation, how do I get the extreme UV, the very short distance A infinity algebra out of that? That's more of a research question than an exercise, of course. Make some space. Now, all of this was very abstract, but let me give some concrete examples. Of A infinity algebras, which actually occur in specific boundary conditions or line defects in two-dimensional topological field theory. For example, let me describe the phi cubed A twisted Landau-Ginzburg theory. I'm not going to tell you what a Landau-Ginzburg theory is, what A twisted Landau-Ginzburg theory is, or what this is. I'm just going to tell you that it has two nice boundary conditions with the following A infinity algebra on it. Actually, right, so as I said, when I have one line, I have an infinity algebra. If I have multiple line defects, I get an infinity category. So if I have two line defects, or three line defects, whatever you want, and I consider local operators that live between defects, I will get A infinity operations, which allow you to compose any number of them. That's what's called an infinity category. OK, so this category will have two elements, L1 and L2. Now, the endomorphisms of L1, which are the sort of the local operators that live on L1, consist only of the identity. I mean, every line defect will have an identity operator, which is I don't put an operator. And obviously, it gives you, if I compose the identity with something else, you get the something else back. If I try to apply a Hager operation to the identity, I get zero. Just because if I try to descend the identity, I get nothing. The endomorphisms of L2 also consist only of C. And there are no local operators which interpolate between L2 and L1. And there is a single local operator which interpolates between L1 and L2. And goes number 0. So let's try to study this system. First of all, I could look for deformations of L1. Well, not much I can do, because I only have the identity there in those numbers C1. And also L2 has no deformations. Now, I don't need to, I can still keep going, because there is an interesting variation of the notion of Mercartan element. So until now, I described the deformation of one line. But there is another operation, which is the direct sum, that is avoided in quantum field theory. So whenever I choose defects, or even choose theories, I can take their direct sum. What does direct sum mean? When I have a direct sum of theories, the local operators are just the direct sum of the local operators, but of the two theories. And correlation functions are computed by sort of taking the operators from one theory and doing their own correlation function. Sort of plus the correlation functions of the operator that belong to the other theory. It seems a very artificial construction, but it has a physical meaning. For example, if I have a theory which is gapped and has two vacua at low energy, you can convince yourself that it becomes a direct sum of two simpler theories, each attached to one of the two vacua. Anyway, I don't want to discuss the physical meaning of this too much. I just wanted to say that whenever I have two line defects, I can build another line defect, which is just a direct sum.
Can I object to something you just said?
Hmm? Sorry, that's true. That was a lie, which I'll admit. I was talking about theories in more than one dimension. Something special happens for one-dimensional things, because then you get matrices. Right, so the idea is that the local operators of L1 plus L2 are just matrices of morphisms of operators. Which belong to, you know, which interpolate between Li and Lj. So to give an operator for the direct sum of two lines, I'm going to give a collection of operators, one from L1 to L1, one from L1 to L2, one from L2 to L1, one from L2 to L2. And then the composition of operators is just by matrix composition. So it's also true that if you give me two-way infinity algebras, you can think about their sum. But again, the infinity operation, the new algebra is really matrices of elements, and the compositions use the matrix multiplication together with the composition rules of the underlying algebra. Maybe just a plus. So you can take direct sums for different lines, you can take multiple copies of the same line and add them up. And another thing you can do is you can take a line and sort of shift it in degree. Meaning that the local operators between L shifting the degree by 1 and L2 will be the operators between L1 and L2 shifted in degree. So something like this. So after setting these things aside, I can try to build more interesting things in this category. For example, I can take L1 plus L2 shifted in degree by 1. Let me call this L tilde. So the endomorphisms of L tilde are now some nice matrix. There are the two original identities. And then there is sort of these shifted by 1. So now, by the way, so here the differential, I didn't say how to compose these things. But right, the differential, essentially the differential, all the operations are trivial. The differential is trivial, the multiplication is trivial, apart from the fact that identity times something is something. And identity times identity is identity. So all the mu's, the mu n's, are as zero as possible. And so now, here I have a nice Mauricartan element, because this guy has Gauss number 1, and if I square it, I clearly get 0 because it's an off-diagonal 2 by 2 matrix. So I can take X in home L1, L2 shifted by 1. And so it also belongs in the endomorphisms of L tilde. And I can consider the deformation of L tilde. I call it L3. It's going to be the deformation of L tilde by the Mauricartan element X. So as an exercise, I invite you to study the properties of this L3. I told you how the differential and Heiger operations are modified by adding a Mauricartan element. So you can try to figure out what the endomorphisms of these are. And perhaps you can find a quasi-isomorphism that makes it behave much like L1 and L2. And more generally, you can sort of ask yourself, what are all possible deformations of this collection? So in general, so there is this idea which I would love to hear more about mathematically, which is that if somebody gives me a construction of some line defects, I can look at all possible line defects that I can obtain from those by deformations. Right, so if somebody gives me some A infinity category calligraphic A, or even just an infinity algebra, I can look at all possible Mara-Kartan elements built by taking direct sums of objects in A and deforming. I don't know what name does this construction have, but it's a bigger A infinity category. It's a bigger collection of line defects. And the funny thing is that this has some kind of a completeness property, because if I take some line and I deform it by some Mara-Kartan element to some new line, and then look for some Mara-Kartan element for this line to get a third line, you can show that you can go directly from here to here by just literally taking the sum of the two Mara-Kartan elements. So the Mara-Kartan equation for L prime, for y inside L prime, is just what you need for this sum to satisfy the Mara-Kartan equation in L. So this is some kind of a completion of the original category.
Universal deformation.
Good. And physically, I would expect that if I study a theory, I would do this a lot. Simply because, if somebody gives me, say, to study a sigma model, I'll be able to produce a recipe to build a whole variety of boundary conditions, but probably not all of them. For example, in the B-twisted sigma model, I might be able to write down a Lagrangian for a boundary condition associated to, a vector bundle, an holomorphic vector bundle of my target space. But that's probably more or less it, or maybe Dirichlet boundary conditions for some skyscrapers or something like that. And then I'll have to sort of try to figure out what are other boundary conditions for the theory by deforming the original ones. Now, if this was a true topological field theory, I would probably do other operations that I would feel confident doing. For example, something called Karubi completion, where I take all projectors and that sort of and I think about them as selecting a piece of the original line. So decomposing all lines into direct sum or sub-objects as much as possible. I have no idea what that is in the infinity world, and I would love to hear more about that from the audience. But, right, so there is this intuition that in physics I would build a bunch of boundary conditions in the UV, whatever description of the theory I have, and then complete it as much as possible. And I expect that a lot of mathematical structures which are attached to physical theories have been built by this sort of implicitly or explicitly by this sort of completion. For example, when you look at first sight as the definition of the right category of coherent sheaves, when as a physics graduate student you encounter this the first time, it doesn't look very physical. There are all sorts of bizarre axioms that have a mysterious physical meaning. I assume you could get it by completing some physically understandable A infinity category of boundary conditions for the B model. And I'll be very interested to hear if that's really the case. Or even better, when you encounter things like the right categories of D modules or microlocal sheaves or whatever else you like to use. Or representations of a quiver or whatnot. I think there is a certain amount of translation work that still needs to be done to be able to really have a physical to be able to employ physical intuition in studying these mathematical structures. Okay. Now this example can be generalized in a variety of ways. For example, part of my results with Murren Witten were that if I have a theory which, and somebody tells me is gapped in the infrared HOD theory, then the boundary conditions should be constructible starting from an exceptional collection, where I have a bunch of lines Li and endomorphisms of Li are C and Hom from Li to Lj are zero if I bigger than J is an exceptional collection. So for all of these theories, whatever is your UV, that your UV analysis of the theory gives you, it must be reconstructible from an exceptional collection. Another simple example that I like a lot is the B model on CP1. Which looks almost like this, except that Hom L1, L2 is C2. So in the B model on CP1, you can take, there are boundary conditions associated to bundles, holomorphic bundles on CP1s. You can take O and O1, and it has these properties. And there are some physical motivations for thinking that O and O1 or something like that will form an exceptional collection without, before even doing any calculations. By the way, I would like to hear if you know any theories for which the Homs, which gives an exceptional collection with three elements. With two elements, but where the Homs are C3. I don't know any. I'm curious to know if this would actually exist. Are there any obstructions to finding a theory like that? Okay, looks like I'm out of time, actually. There was a bunch of two more pages of stuff I wanted to say, but I think I'll leave it for tomorrow, for next week. So that's B model Landau-Ginzburg. That's right. A model Landau-Ginzburg is related to Fukaya-Seidel if this is Morse, if the function is Morse. And otherwise, to some, still Fukaya with super potential, whatever that means.
So then I just want to sort of confirm that it kind of seemed to me like your whole talk was about one-dimensional, sort of topological homotopy theories.
Well, not theories, defects.
Well, but so was there something I missed about two-dimensional theories that these guys are hearing?
Well, there wasn't. Okay. There should have been. I mean.
So somehow you only told us about what was happening.
Yes, on the defect. That's right.
Just a one-dimensional.
And then a few more pages that I didn't talk about would discuss what the environment where these lines live in does to them.
Okay.
Right, the discussion at the moment doesn't even assume 2D. Right, what I said would be true about the line topological line defect in any homological topological field theory. And then you would have extra structures on top that depends on the environment where this line defect lives.
But, I mean, for example, did it actually matter that the ambient theory was homologically topological? Would it have been enough to get a translation in the direction of the line, but maybe things are holomorphic in the other coordinates?
I think you're correct. For example, this structure also persists for line defects in a theory which, say, I can have a five-dimensional theory which has one topological direction and two holomorphic. Just say something I've been obsessing with for a few months. Right. then you can have a line defect which wraps the topological direction and is a point in the holomorphic directions. And that will still be associated to an infinity algebra or whatnot.
Right, so somehow the only thing that's in place is
yes, that's right. There's a topological line somewhere.